Hello from Brooklyn, I'm Brendan Hart, and welcome to Super Cities, a no BS deep dive conversation about the people and trends moving cities forward. All views expressed are my own and do not reflect our sponsors or partners. Let's get into it. On this episode of Super Cities, we do a deep dive on all things cybersecurity with Tom Sammel, the Director of Threat Operations for Provitech. Earlier in his career, Tom was the Chief Information Security Officer for KKR, the global private equity firm, and spent 24 years in the Marine Corps, including extensive work in cybersecurity. Let's hear from Tom. Tom, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So it's always good for us to set a little bit of context for how our guest got to this point. Can you just give us a little bit of background? How did you get to this point in your cybersecurity career? Were there key decisions you made along the way, or were there inflection points in either your career path or the market that you chose to work in?
So the funny thing is I actually fell into cybersecurity almost by chance. And it was a really good thing that it did happen, because when I first joined the Joint Task Force Computer Network Operations, which became Joint Task Force Global Network Operations, which is the predecessor to Cyberspace Command, that was really the place where I cut my teeth on information security, cybersecurity, and that's where I really fell in love with the entire concept. Prior to that, I'd been doing information technology as a general scope for the previous 9 or 10 years. And so then becoming a cybersecurity officer, one of the really first ones in the Marine Corps to be dedicated to that, was a huge inflection point. The other big inflection point for me was when I left the Marine Corps and I went into the commercial world with, at the time, was Dell SecureWorks and eventually became SecureWorks, and spending 4.5 years on the incident response, breach response team. That was an incredible opportunity where we responded to several hundred incidents, large and small, companies that spanned across from energy to retail to financial to electric power, and seeing what types of attacks were occurring with them, and really getting a clear understanding of what the threats were, how they were evolving in the market, and what we needed to do to fight against those threats.
So you've been in this space for many years. You were working on issues of cybersecurity before cybersecurity was a widely understood term. Zoom out for us here. How are things in the world of cybersecurity today? A lot of the headlines tend to drift towards existential risks. But from your seat in the world, what is the state of cybersecurity? Are there issues that are being undervalued, or are there issues that are being underappreciated? And at the same on the same side, are there issues that are being overhyped? Are we not as vulnerable as sort of the non-technical would come to believe?
I think overall, the current state of cybersecurity in the United States and around the world is generally not good. I think that is that an
understatement?
It's pretty close. Okay. It's pretty right on. The overall posture of the world is not good. We are very reactive to the threats that are out there. We are almost always a step or two or three behind where the threats are. They continue to evolve their tactics faster than we evolve our defenses. Part of that is technology. A big part of that is people. I think that there are a few organizations, both public and private, that are well protected. They do their job well. Those are organizations that have really built security writ large, not just cybersecurity, but security, and built that into their culture. Most organizations, unfortunately, haven't. Most, unfortunately, live with the illusion that if they have firewalls and they have IDSs, intrusion detection systems, intrusion prevention systems, they have endpoint protection, they're safe. But what they end up doing is they end up implementing a lot of these technologies and not really teaching their people exactly how to implement them to their most thorough technological capability. I think any organization that goes into their existence or a new chief information security officer or an IT security manager or a chief information officer or even a CEO or a CFO of a corporation, I think if they think they're really well protected, the best thing for them to do is ask a well-qualified penetration tester, get in, and give that penetration tester carte blanche to do it any way that they want. And then they'll really find out whether or not they are protected.
Let me ask you a question about the cybersecurity space or the cybersecurity market. Unpack it a little bit for me. How cybersecurity evolved over your time working in this space? Is it you've mentioned technologies, you've mentioned leadership, you've mentioned training and personnel. How has the space evolved over, call it 20 years, and where are the trend lines indicating that the market is going?
So back once upon a time, and many people that have been around for these last 20 years, where they've been teenagers or adults and on, I think they'll remember things like the blaster worm and the Melissa worm, and those were worms that traversed the internet and would do significant damage to computers and computer networks. There were times when the entire Department of Defense simply isolated itself from the internet because these worms were so rampant and we needed to be able to clean our networks before we would connect back to the internet writ large. But what's happened over time is the internet's become weaponized. Cybercrime, hacktivists, terrorists, they've learned that they can use the internet as a tool. They've learned that they can use malware, malicious code as tools. There are huge repositories of malware that they can source, and they can modify them as they need to so that they can use them as weapons. The most concerning portion of weaponization is by organized crime and nation states. They're sophisticated, they're well-funded, they have focus. And if you think back to the attack with Malaysia and the SWIFT transaction, cyber criminals, whether they're really truly attributed to a nation state, which some people believe they are, was the theft of $81 million. The largest physical theft up to that point, I believe, was somewhere on the order of $10 to $15 million, where someone actually stole that much in gold or money or something. But this was an $81 million theft that occurred simply because of the connectivity that the threat actors had to the internet.
Interesting. So can you talk a little bit about the ecosystem? So as a consumer, I imagine I have a different cyber threat profile than an enterprise or a leader in an enterprise. On the adversary side, there's a host of cyber actors from non-state to the hacktivist type. What are the driving motivations for some of these cyber adversaries? What do they want from me? Do they want my money? Do they want control over my digital space? Do they want for me to live in fear? Why are we, outside of the technical considerations, why is cybersecurity such a large issue and such a large threat to everybody every day?
That's a great question. And the reality for the why is based on the who. So nation states want to control and influence events around the world from a cybersecurity perspective so that they can advance their national goals. Cyber criminals simply want money, so they're going to attack and execute operations such that they can gather money. Hacktivists, terrorists, it's ideological to them, so they'll leverage the internet and their ability to manipulate the internet to be able to propagate their goals. Going back those 20 years, at the time, it was more of a thrill to be able to hack and to be able to gain access to someone's computer was exciting. It was the thrill of the chase and the capture of the system. And then it has evolved over time with that weaponization in these past, certainly 10 to 15 years, where now it's not so much the thrill, it's more the end result that you can achieve.
Does it matter for me what the motivations are? If I'm vulnerable to cyber intrusion, whether it's from a nation state actor or a hacktivist, do I need to concern myself with their motivations, or do I just need to double down on my own cyber protection?
If you are an organization, or a public entity, then it could be the point where you have to do some level of risk analysis to figure out who is the greater threat to you. Someone in the defense industrial base, their threat is probably going to be more towards nation states or corporate espionage. If it's a financial company, the threats focusing on them are probably going to be more cyber criminally driven. But even organizations that are nonprofits, they could be used as hop points for anybody. So to answer your question a little bit more specifically, it really doesn't matter who you are. It's just simply a function of you have to continue to try and tighten and advance your cybersecurity day by day, week by week.
Understood. But you have the wide lens here. And so out of all of these threat actors, which one or which ones concern you the most as a leader within this industry?
What concerns me is what I don't know. What's next? So when you think of things like the Target breach and the Home Depot breach and the breach against the Office of Management and Budget here in the United States, when you think of breaches against some of the banks in Europe, when you look at the theft of the $81 million in the SWIFT transaction, what's next? Does someone gain control of an entire stock market and manipulate that stock market so that they can gain some type of financial advantage? Is there a more massive theft on the order of billions of dollars is lost to whether it's a nation state or a cyber criminal group? That's what really concerns me, is what's that next step? We've also seen an evolution. You asked about evolution before. In the last 5 to 8 years, but certainly within the last 5 years, we've seen a greater increase of destructive attacks that have gone on against various entities. Saudi Aramco was hit. Sands Corporation was hit. The Stuxnet attacks against Iran, which then also had some spillover effects to non-Iranian entities. Those are all a step up in the escalation of the weaponization of the internet.
It seems to be one of the large challenges with the rapidly evolving cybersecurity market is that there's not clearly defined and respected boundaries. Under the Obama administration, there was talks about a grand bargain between the United States and China as to what would be off limits for targeting purposes. Cyber targeting purposes. But if that's not even defined, how does it exist in the market? It seems to me that there needs to be some operational framework that would define how partnerships work, where one company or one individual's cyber presence bleeds over into an enterprise's cyber presence or another individual's cyber profile. What's the state of the cyber partnership, whether it's public to public or public and private? If the market as a whole is not doing particularly well, how is the partnership component of the market?
So I think if you're going to talk about partnerships, you have to talk about roles and responsibilities. And as a general rule, the roles and responsibilities, what we are each inclined to do or need to do, they're generally fairly well defined. Public has a certain function to it. The military has a certain function to it. Corporate entities have a certain application to it. Individuals have a certain responsibility, although far less than others. But I think those individual roles and responsibilities are pretty well built out. From a partnership perspective, I think that there are some pretty good models that that exist today. The information sharing and analysis centers, the ISACs, the information sharing and analysis organizations, the ISAOs, those are good examples. The financial services ISAC has a really well built out model that they use in the transfer of information across all of the different participants of the FS ISAC, the financial services ISAC is good. Energy is good, but there are some organizations that they're a little bit more nascent. They're on their way to building that capability. Retail is one of them. They don't really share information as well across entities as they could or they should. But those are probably a pretty good public-private model, because not only do the financial service entities within the FS-ISAC share information with each other, they're also sharing it back to the Department of Homeland Security, and the Department of Homeland Security is sharing it into them also.
Okay, so the banks and the financial services companies are members or participants in this model?
Yes.
Is that right?
Okay. Yes.
And so they share information amongst peer organizations and then socialize that information and or partner with government entities that also have responsibility in the cyberspace. Am I understanding the model correctly?
Responsibilities, I'd have to actually look at the charter, but the ISACs themselves are coordinated through the Department of Homeland Security through the U.S. CERT. And so they do have a responsibility to help share information that they can. It has to be unclassified information that they share into the FS-ISAC model.
I read something that the U.S. government designated the financial services industry as critical infrastructure.
Yes.
And can you talk a little bit about that? Because that being labeled or designated critical infrastructure gives sectors additional resources, as I understand it, additional resources or a priority in the allocation of resources or expertise. Am I thinking about that correctly, or is there are there other sort of reasons to be designated and or reasons not to want that designation?
Yeah, so I believe you're right. And I will freely admit that I am not an expert on public policy, but there are a number of different critical sectors, such as the electric sector, financial sector, chemical sector, oil and petroleum. All of these are designated as critical infrastructure. And because they're designated as critical infrastructure, they have certain relationships exist with the federal government, so that the federal government can provide input and intelligence that help those critical infrastructures better secure themselves. Unlike some countries, such as Venezuela, where the oil industry is a part of the government, that's not the case. The vast majority of critical infrastructure that exists within the United States is privately held. And even those that are not are going to be kind of small organizations like municipal electric companies. They're not truly public, private entities, but they are small, and they still also need to be plugged into the larger critical infrastructure information sharing function.
Yeah, it's such an interesting point. I come across a lot of non-security peers who think about critical infrastructure as roads, bridges, subway systems, sort of the traditional hard asset critical infrastructure. But I think the term has evolved over time to include industries that are critical to the economy, which feels like a pretty significant evolution and a good one in many ways. How is the leadership in Washington, D.C. What's their level of understanding generally? What's their level of concern or pragmatism around this rapidly evolving cybersecurity threat environment?
I would say that within the Beltway, within Washington, D.C., there are a few in leadership positions, Congress, Senate, House of Representatives, and within the administration themselves. I think there are a few that get it. I think there are more that have an idea and a pretty decent ability to speak to cybersecurity as a whole. I think the vast majority don't get it. I think they think of cybersecurity as just another piece of physical security. When you think of how our law enforcement acts today, they still are rooted in 18th century British law. And the laws for being able to respond to cybersecurity just simply haven't caught up with 18th century British common law.
Can you give an example? Do law enforcement not have jurisdiction over certain cyber activities? So even if they were able to recognize an event, they don't have the authority or ability to respond. Is that right?
So if you think of the concept of search and seizure, which is granted under the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, and there are certain rules that have to be abided by, and you put that in context of, again, 18th century British common law, the vast majority of crimes occurred person to person, human to human. There had to be some type of physical interaction. And so the ability to trace that crime back to a person was able to be done fairly straightforward. And then if you wanted to execute some type of search of that person's property, you fall under the Fourth Amendment. You have to apply for a search warrant and you go from there. Attackers actually leverage that fact in the United States against us. So if an attacker wants to try and steal money from a small hospital by executing some type of wire transfer surreptitiously, what they do is they start in country X, they hop to country Y, which doesn't have a very good relationship with the United States. They hop into the United States from there, hop into another state, and then hop into the little hospital. So now you're dealing with two or three states, three different countries, all with different sets of laws. So the ability to access the information, they can do that at the place where the theft occurred, which is at the hospital. But then to be able to execute search warrants back to state number two, state number three, and then nation number, letter A, is extraordinarily difficult and time-consuming. And so those only get the attention if the amount of theft reaches a certain level.
Sid, this sounds like a complex game of cat and mouse, where the defensive side is perpetual, at least currently, is perpetually at a disadvantage, both in terms of immediate incentive, but also in terms of governing superstructure of policies that haven't updated to a new age, where a teenage hacker in name the country can execute the scenario that you just described, but all of American law enforcement resources would have a difficult time reverse engineering that activity.
So a friend of mine was on a mission trip on the west coast of Africa, and one of the interesting things that he learned while he was there is people that would execute some level of fraud event using a little internet cafe and a 28 baud dial-up modem from the internet cafe. If they were able to execute some level of fraud that allowed them to steal $50, they were actually considered heroes in their village. And it's a very different model than how we think of it in the United States. And he actually walked into one of these internet cafes, and there was a book called Google Hacks, and I actually have a copy of it here in the office. There was a book called Google Hacks, and this book was well-used, well-dog-eared, and it was clear that there were a number of people that used that book and that internet cafe to try and execute fraud to just get an extra $20, $30, $50, $100 for them and their family. It's absolutely astounding to kind of get a sense of the scale when that's happening in some country on the west coast of Africa, and it's accepted. It's not only accepted, it's rewarded.
If the last number of years in the cybersecurity space have been defined by these sort of large these large hacks and sort of email penetrations, but the commercial market generally is moving towards proliferation of connected devices, IoT, driverless vehicles, data in the cloud. How is the average person's vulnerability profile changing, whether they know it or not?
It's going to become far more complex. If you think of connected houses, if you have your stove connected to your home router, wireless router, the same with your security system, the same with your refrigerator, the same with your heating and air conditioning. If an attacker is able to compromise your home router, if the connections between those Internet of Things devices and your router are not secured, they can now potentially intercept those communications or even get onto those devices. If you take it to another level of access to driverless cars or driver-assisted cars, if an attacker is able to gain access to the car while it's driving, what can it do? Can it slam on the brakes when it shouldn't? Can it cause the car to veer off the road when it shouldn't? I think one of the clear movements of driverless vehicles is actually going to be in the trucking industry. What happens if that's a truck that's carrying some level of toxic material or flammable or combustible material, and an attacker is able to gain access to the onboard computers of that vehicle?
Right. This to me seems like one of the real challenges. In some ways, cybersecurity is such a large concept that for non-practitioners or non-experts, it feels overwhelming. It feels like that, you know, I have a difficult time making sure my email is secure. Should I ever get in a autonomous vehicle or connect my my stove to my refrigerator? It feels sort of like an overwhelming space. But I know there's a lot of good work being done. There's sort of a lot of resources being put against this problem set. Where are the glaring gaps in the cybersecurity market? And to be proactive here, what are some of the things that need to happen to close these glaring gaps?
So some of the biggest gaps actually occur at some of the smaller companies, certainly individuals, but smaller companies. The larger companies will throw generally sufficient money at the issue, although they may not always do it the smartest way. A lot of them do. They're trying to do it for the right reasons. But it's the small companies that are really vulnerable. They typically don't have the amount of free cash to be able to apply to security. They're trying to grow their business, so they're reinvesting in business operations as opposed to cybersecurity. And so they actually become significant targets. And when attackers are able to gain access to them, they'll oftentimes use their access to the smaller company to be able to then further gain access to a larger company. And that's actually what happened with the Target breach. It was a mechanical company that was breached. And then since they had access into the Target environment to manage their HVAC systems, that's how they eventually gained access into Target.
So that's an important point. So this was a subcontractor or a partner organization to a much larger entity, target, multinational, a lot of resources, a lot of assets. But Target doesn't live or operate in isolation, right? Target has
they have partner organizations.
They have partner organizations. And if a big component of cybersecurity is initial point of penetration, then there's all these cascading effects that that need to be thought about. What are sort of some practical things that we can think about or utilize, some strategies or tactics, both on an individual level? How can Brendan be more secure in my own sort of cybersecurity profile? But how can we carry some of those things forward to the small business that may not have the resources or the large enterprise?
So the first thing that we have to do is we have to take a page out of Stephen Covey's book, literally out of his book. We have to face the brutal reality of our situation. We cannot put our heads in the sand and say, well, I'm just an individual, so I'm never going to be targeted. I'm just a small company. The bad guys wouldn't want to come after me. Yes, they will, and they do. So you still have to do those things that help protect you. And from my perspective, when I talk with people, especially older people, my father and my aunts and uncles and things like that, they'll ask me my advice on what do I need to do, Tom? And for every individual, it really boils down to the basics. First thing, passwords. There are so many things that we can do with passwords, and I'll touch on a couple of them. First thing, I use a password manager, a password vault. It's called KeePass. There are a couple of them that are out there. All I have to do is remember one long password phrase. It's something I guarantee you I will never forget. And
no one else would ever know.
And no one else will ever know. I use that one passphrase, gain access to my password manager, and then all of the passwords that I use for banks, for emails, for all the different services that I participate in. I just actually created one for Experian today. The Experian password is 28 characters long. I have absolutely no idea what that password is, but it's locked in my password vault. So if I ever need to use it, I open my password vault and then I can gain access to that password.
It's just the funny aside, you may have seen, but last week, or maybe it was this week, things are moving so fast. Kanye West was in the Oval Office and he unlocked his iPhone with zero, all zero, zeros. Zero. Not exactly password hygiene.
So that actually happened in one of the last few Olympics where they had moved the picture into one of the control centers for whatever the broadcast company was. And on the wall, on a piece of paper on the wall, was the password to one of their systems. So I guess you're going to have to change it from 0000 to 1234.
Yeah, right.
But so the other thing I do with this password vault is it's just a small little file. If my computer ever crashed, in theory, I'd lose all those passwords, which would be fairly traumatic. But all I do is I just take that one file, which again is encrypted with a very long password that I know, and I just send it to myself in my personal email. So even if someone gets that, they really can't do anything because they still don't have that long password. But what it does is it backs it up for me, and I do that every couple of months to make sure I have the most
and
recent.
These password managers are not. This is a couple bucks a month subscription service or something, right?
KeePass is free.
Yeah, great.
Don't reuse passwords. Use a password generator and have long, complex passwords through this password vault. Use two-factor authentication wherever you can. Banks will allow you to do it. Sometimes it's as simple as just having them send you a text message. When you try and log on with your password, they'll send you a text message and they'll give you a six-digit or an eight-digit number code, and you plug that in, and now you can log on. You can also do that with personal email like Hotmail or Webmail or Gmail. That's another thing you can do. Opt for SMS text message verification on your credit card and your bank transactions. When you execute something at Walmart or Target or something, and you use your credit card, have the credit card company send you something that says you just spent $21.35 at Walmart. And you know that that's accurate. And then if you get something where you haven't used your credit card, you can now respond to that far more quickly. You know, protect your personal information. Check your bank accounts and your credit card activity regularly. Check your credit report. Limit the personal information on your home computer. I'll throw myself under the bus here and tell you, I used to keep all of my TurboTax records on a computer unencrypted. And one day I'm going through my computer and I realize I had 5 years worth of TurboTax records, all of my tax returns, which if someone had hacked my computer, they could have easily gotten to. That includes social security numbers, dates of birth, names, more information than I would want someone to be able to have. So I obviously took care of that and got those removed. Some other things that I really strongly encourage is to have older people get educated, because they are oftentimes, from a cyber perspective and a fraud perspective, very highly targeted. And if you can educate them on things like cyber kidnapping, email spoofing, you know, people soliciting money for things that they shouldn't on the internet. I've seen instances where older people get an email from who they think is their grandchild saying that they're in a foreign country and they've been arrested and they need $200 wired to this bank account. Otherwise, they're not going to be able to get out. They've taken their passport, and they really prey on the emotions of an older person. And you'd be surprised, maybe you wouldn't be surprised, at the number of times that older people fall victim to this.
It's such an interesting point. I recently had a conversation with my mother about this, she's a sophisticated lady, and she's technically savvy for her age, but just the number of vulnerable points of entry. I mean, I have a difficult time sort of staying on top of it, and you can imagine I'm digitally connected. I sort of work in this space. There's a large number of people, some older, some younger, who are just not as fluent in some of these strategies or tactics. And how would we educate? I mean, what would be sort of an education at scale that would be meaningful to raise the threshold of intrusion? Should this be part of an education curriculum? Should it be part of ongoing professional training? Some combination thereof. What would that look like?
So I actually had this very issue when I was the chief information security officer at KKR. There's a focus within the company on adding value to the investors and increasing their returns. And it's very business-centric, business-focused, acquisition-focused as far as making money for the investors. Cybersecurity really was not a high priority for the vast majority of people at the company. And when I first joined, I recognized that there was a big gap with where I wanted people to be and where they were. And so what I began was a monthly newsletter that I would release to the employees around the company. And invariably, every time I released the newsletter, I would get back a dozen, 20 emails from people. Hey, this exact thing happened to a friend of mine, or I didn't really know that was such a big deal. Thank you for sharing that with me. Now that's good for businesses to do and for organizations to do, but for individuals, sometimes it's rooting out and finding a newsletter that they can subscribe to that's not going to give them something every day in their inbox, because most people aren't going to read something on cybersecurity every day. I do, but it's my job. But for people that it's not their job, find a newsletter that you can get once a month and just gradually increase your knowledge on various matters.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It feels like a term that resonates with me as it relates to cybersecurity is hygiene. It's just, it's an ongoing process. It's never over. It becomes part of the routine.
Yeah. When people leave the house, they lock the doors. When people go away on vacation, they check the windows. They make sure that the stove is turned off. They lock the doors, make sure that the dog is either in the car or at a friend's house, and then they can leave. And it's that same level of basic hygiene that we want to try and get across to the vast majority of citizenry in the United States. And it's not easy. It doesn't port as easy, especially for people that are not digital natives. They're digital immigrants.
Right, right. I just wanted to ask you quickly about cities. We're really interested in what connected cities are like, how technology and people and systems come together in cities. There's natural budgetary constraints at a municipal or city level. Are people in big cities more vulnerable because of IoT connected devices, sort of ubiquitous technology, are they more vulnerable than people who are not in cities? Are there issues, cybersecurity issues that are unique to cities, or should we be thinking about cybersecurity not as something that has a geographical constraint, but more about the digital footprint that we have in the world?
I freely admit I can be completely off base here. I think that the difference between cities and towns, or cities and rural areas, there are certainly some differences just in the sheer density of people there. But from the perspective of vulnerabilities, I think it cuts across all. In a word, cities, towns, municipalities are vulnerable. In two words, they're very vulnerable. If we look at states across the board, in a word, they're vulnerable. In two words, they're very vulnerable. And this cuts across, think about municipal water. They are industrial control systems, SCADA-connected networks, municipal electric, commercial electric, in all of these locations. These cities, the towns, the states, they're extraordinarily vulnerable. You hit on the fact of budget. There are a number of locations throughout the nation that simply have not had the money to invest in upgrades. It would be scary for you to know the number of municipal water supplies that are running on Windows XP or Windows 95 or Windows 2000.
And is that a budget issue, or is that a technology fluency issue, or something else? Why is that the case? That to me sounds alarming. I know it to be true, but how do we energize the progress from moving from some version of an analog system to a digital system?
So there are a couple of different answers to that, and no one is the only. So the first basic answer to that question is it's budgetary. Organizations just simply haven't budgeted to make sure that the upgrades occur. But the analog piece to that, and I don't mean digital analog, but the corollary piece to that is, if you look at where cybersecurity professionals are working, we're a fairly rare breed, and we're going to get rarer in the next 15 to 20 years, certainly the next 5 years. And we are getting drawn into commercial entities because they're the ones that are willing to pay for that skill set. There's a couple funny stories, but one funny story was when I was working at SecureWorks, we had gotten a call from a law firm, and the law firm had been breached. It was a pretty bad breach, and they had some information loss that they were dealing with. And after we had gone through the initial scope and we got a sense of how large the breach was, the individual that we were speaking with, which was the chief information officer, and they also had their general counsel, who was a lawyer, on the call, and they had asked the question about what was the cost. And at that point, from an incident response perspective, I kind of stepped back and let the account representative take the lead, and the account representative gave him a sense of the cost per hour that it was going to be. And their response was, we don't even pay our lawyers that much. We're not going to pay you that.
Right. As if this is part of a common negotiation instead of a cyber breach response.
And general counsel actually had the chutzpah to ask, why do you think you're worth that much? And it was a simple answer for me. And I tended to be a wise guy anyway. So I said, well, quite honestly, there are far fewer digital forensics and cybersecurity experts than there are lawyers. You can't swing a dead cat without hitting a lawyer in this country.
It's a good response.
He didn't like that answer, yeah. But it was the reality.
Right.
It's supply and demand.
And so as a result, commercial interests who are able to pay this group of cyber experts and tend to have a lot of the brain power, right?
Right. And so you have a general dearth of highly qualified cyber expertise in states, in municipalities, because they simply don't have the structure in place. They don't recognize the cost that they have to incur so that they have the right level of expertise in their city, in their town, in their state.
Right. Right. That's really something to ponder. I mean,
so I just want to add one thing, and maybe I'm being a little bit politically correct here. There are pockets of really sharp individuals that they just want to serve and they want to do it in a public capacity, and they're very good. But I think my comments really go as in a much larger scope as opposed to those individual pockets.
Sure, sure, sure. But it's a good point. Anything else that we should be thinking about in the world of cybersecurity? What haven't we talked about? What haven't we touched on? That's something that you think about, or your colleagues think about, growing concerns, growing trends to start to recognize.
So I've touched on a couple of them. The thing that I worry about the most is what's next. I think the trend of destructive attacks, we're only at the very beginning of that. I think over the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to see a much higher incidence of destructive attacks. And when I say destructive attacks, I mean people are going to come after electrical grids. They're going to come after water treatment. They're going to come after financial networks and try and manipulate networks, try and manipulate markets. I think that the technologies that are evolving are going to transform cybersecurity significantly over the next 5 to 10 years, and then certainly beyond that. The two that jump to mind for me are blockchain and then also quantum computing. Quantum computing, it's at its very nascent stages, but there are already qubit machines that exist today, and they're being built. They're not at a point where they can have a systematic effect on encryption and security, but within the next 5 to 10 years, it's possible, and certainly within the next 20 years, it's probable that quantum computing machines will render existing encryption and existing password structures completely obsolete.
Can you just give the very quick overview of what quantum computing is and why it's so powerful?
So quantum computing has the ability to operate at multiple states at the same time. So if you think in terms of a transistor in a normal computer, it can either be a one or it can be a zero, depending upon the energy that's applied to it. In quantum computing, it can be both at the same time. And so if quantum computing continues to evolve the way it's evolving, what you're able to do is look I told you I have a 28-bit password that I put in for Experian that hopefully no one can guess. But a quantum computer that can operate on a 28-bit structure would, in theory, be able to crack my password in microseconds.
Right. And so at scale, that applied to things beyond an individual password.
People probably don't want my Experian report.
Right, right, right. Lucky you, right? Lucky me too. Okay, so let's close with some rapid fire questions, if you would allow. What are you reading now? What do you read on a typical day or over a typical week?
I have a couple of websites that I prefer. Ars Technica is one of them. Dark Reading is another one. Those are probably my big go-to websites where I keep up to date. From a book perspective, I just recently finished a book on SCADA security. Shortly before that, I finished Anna Karenina by Tolstoy. I think you have to have a good balance of reading.
I was going to ask, do you do non-security reading?
Absolutely. Before that, I read a book on financial planning. Try and stay as well-rounded as I possibly can, but definitely keep dialed into the cybersecurity.
Yeah, it feels like if you've been doing this for so long and you need to be keeping up to date, the rest of us need to put in a little sweat equity to reach some passable level. Where can listeners find you online? Are you on any of the social media platforms or company sites? Contact information, anything that we can find you?
So Provatech has a low profile, low internet profile, so you will not find me there. You will find me on LinkedIn. It is the only social media that I participate in. I don't participate in Facebook or Instagram or Twitter or any of those. I do that on purpose. It gives me a lower profile than maybe some people would like me to have, but it gives me the profile that I'm comfortable with.
Discretion in 2018, that feels like something to be appreciated and celebrated. Thanks so much, Tom Samuel. It's been a great conversation, and I think we all learned a lot about cybersecurity. Thank you.
Thanks, Brennan.
That does it for this episode of Super Cities. Before we go, some real talk. Cities feel broken. Too expensive, too crowded, too chaotic. So we created Super Cities to elevate the people and trends moving cities forward. This movement is just getting started, so please rate, review, and subscribe to Super Cities and tag us using hashtag Super Cities. Your support really helps, and I'm thankful for it. This is Brendan Hart and Super Cities, signing off for now.